The Taliban spokesman says the group will soon form an inclusive government. He pledges the group wants to have friendly relations with its neighbors. China accuses the U.S. of, quote, leaving an awful mess in Afghanistan after the Taliban took over the country. And Russia urging all ethnic groups in Afghanistan to hold political talks on the future of the country. It's good to have you with us. Starting with Afghanistan, the Taliban have vowed to ensure the security of all foreign embassies and international organizations in the country. Taliban spokesman Zabihullah Mujahid made the pledge in the group's first news conference in Kabul since taking control of Afghanistan. Mujahid says the security of embassies in Afghanistan is crucial for the Taliban. He added that former government officials and those who fought against the Taliban have been pardoned. In response to a question of Press TV's correspondent, Mujahid said that the Taliban want peaceful relations with all countries, including Afghanistan's neighbors. He said that the Taliban will soon form an inclusive government. Mujahid has stressed that no one will be allowed to use the Afghan territory for attacks against other nations. Russia says it's receiving encouraging signals from the Taliban for the formation of a government with the participation of other political forces. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said that Moscow supports inclusive national dialogue in Afghanistan, in which all political, ethnic, and religious groups take part. His Turkish counterpart welcomed the Taliban's, quote, positive messages to the international community and hoped for similar actions. Mevlut Çavuşoğlu said that Turkey continues a dialogue with all parties in Afghanistan, including the Taliban. The Pakistani foreign minister also said that an inclusive political settlement is the best way forward to resolve Afghanistan's political impasse. Shah Mahmud Qureshi said that Pakistan would remain closely engaged with its international partners to promote peace and stability in Afghanistan. The Lebanese parliament speaker has called for an open session on Friday to discuss an appropriate action to deal with the country's crippling fuel shortage. The call for parliament session came after a request by President Michel Aoun. Last week, the head of the central bank asked the government to pass a law allowing him to dip into the mandatory reserve for fuel imports. Dwindling fuel supply has placed Lebanon into extended blackouts and long lines for gasoline and bread. Lebanon is grappling with a financial crisis branded by the World Bank as one of the worst in the country since the 1850s. Lebanon has been run by a caretaker administration since August 2020. 10 Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails continue with their hunger strike to protest their illegal administrative detention. Some of them have been transferred from jails to Israeli military clinics after their health condition deteriorated. Mona Kandil has more.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes to protest the illegal Israeli policy of administrative detention. A total of 10 prisoners are going on with their protests, demanding the occupying regime to either release them or prosecute them. According to their families, Israel is responsible for the lives of the hunger strikers, as many were transferred to jails' military clinics after their health conditions deteriorated, while refusing to allow even their lawyers to visit them.
We know that Mujahid was transferred to the Ramleh military clinic. This means he's in a bad health condition. He has been detained over 1 year ago under administrative detention, while he was not tried in Israeli court and there are no charges against him. He decided to start an open-ended hunger strike after the Israeli authorities renewed his administrative detention for the third time. It is unfair.
Scores of Palestinians, including prisoners' relatives and friends, as well as prisoners' advocacy groups, protested outside the building of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Ramallah in solidarity with the hunger-striking prisoners, as well as with the sick inmates who face medical negligence by the Israeli Prisons Administration, while the health conditions of many of them have seriously deteriorated.
We are here today to send a message that the prisoners are not alone in their battle. We are their voice outside the jail. We are here to support the hunger-striking prisoners and to support the sick prisoners, as a number of prisoners' lives are in danger. On top of those sick prisoners are Ayad Herabat and Nasser Abu Hamed. We are demanding the Red Cross Committee to immediately act and save them because their health is seriously deteriorating.
Administrative detention is illegal. However, it's a tactic that allows Israeli authorities to put Palestinians behind bars indefinitely without charge or trial, claiming they were arrested based on secret reports which are inaccessible to prisoners themselves and their lawyers.
Despite international rejection of administrative detentions, Tel Aviv is pushing with the illegal practice. It continues to trigger more hunger strikes by the Palestinian inmates who say their move is a legitimate means to resist the Israeli policy. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Now, since the beginning of the Saudi-led war in Yemen in 2015, Saudi Arabia and its allies have used cluster munition in targeting residential areas. According to a report by Yemen's Mine Action Center, thousands of civilians, including children, were killed by remains of cluster bombs over the past year. Abdul Latif al-Rashid reports.
The remnants of Saudi cluster bombs are another threat to the lives of millions of Yemenis, which will remain even after the Saudi war. According to Yemen's Mine Action Center, the number of victims of the remnants of Saudi cluster bombs has reached 10,000 in the period between July 2020 and July 2021.
The number of cluster bombs that have been discovered and dealt with the Mine Action Center since with the beginning of the war on Yemen has reached about 55,000, including American, British and Brazilian-made ones. The number of victims who were killed by the bombs stands at about 3,700, most of them children and women. Cluster bombs are internationally prohibited weapons.
The head of Yemen's Mine Action Center said most of the victims were children, as the remnants of cluster bombs could be found in farms or streets, and the children would think they are toys.
Children are the main victim of cluster bombs because the remains of the bombs come into forms of foreign and metallic luster objects and looks like toys. Victims usually lose their eyes and suffer from deformities in their bodies.
In a report, the Cluster Munition Monitor accused the Saudi-led coalition of using cluster bombs in Yemen. Over the past years, Saudi Arabia has used internationally prohibited weapons, including the U.S. bombs, to target residential areas across the war-torn country.
As the war goes on, Yemenis continue bearing the brunt of Saudi cluster munitions and indiscriminate devastation. People say the Saudi war and the blockade have turned their lives into a real tragedy. However, the UN turns a blind eye to such violations. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Time now for the news review section. Do stay with us. China has criticized the United States for leaving Afghanistan in turmoil after its abrupt and chaotic conclusion of the 20-year military occupation of the country. The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokeswoman said Washington left an awful mess of unrest, division, and broken families in Afghanistan. Hua Chunying said that America's strength and role is destruction, not construction. The German president also described the situation in Afghanistan as a human tragedy for which Western powers share responsibility. Frank-Walter Steinmeier said that the images of the desperation of fleeing Afghans at the Kabul airport are shameful for the political West. The United Nations said that a humanitarian emergency is unfolding in Afghanistan. It urged the countries to ban all forced returns of Afghans to their conflict-torn nation. Okay, now let's get a couple of guests now. We'll have our own correspondent, Amin Alami, in Kabul. And also we have Tanya Gordusian, Afghan analyst in Istanbul. Welcome both. I saw you taking part in the first press conference after the capture of Kabul by Taliban. Let's first give us an overall picture of what the situation is in Afghanistan. How do people feel about this? Are they optimistic, pessimistic in terms of security? And then I'll proceed with other questions from our guests.
Of course. We were invited to attend the first press conference of the Taliban spokesman Zabihullah Mujahid here in Government Media Information Center here in Kabul. There were dozens of local and international correspondents who had attended this very important press conference by the Taliban spokesman. During his remarks, Zabihullah Mujahid insisted that they are after establishing an inclusive government and said that negotiations are underway between top political leaders and political figures of Afghanistan in order to reach an agreement to establish an inclusive government. He also, unlike the previous stances of the Taliban, he also did not point it out about the name of the coming government or what he named it, the inclusive government. It shows that the Taliban will not insist that the only legitimate government must be the what they want, what they had already insisted on that. Mm-hmm. That is the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. He also emphasized that we need the presence of women in the society, as well as he also stressed that media workers, journalists must stay in Afghanistan. We need them to help us to cooperate to rebuild this country. Without pointing out to the issues or some aspects like democracy or human rights or women rights, he added that the people of Afghanistan are tired of war and the coming government or this inclusive government will pay respect to the old demands of this people. He said that all rules, regulation and law in the coming government will be in line with humanitarian law, humanitarian values, as well as in line with the Islamic values. He also insisted that there would be no threat or danger for many different groups in Afghanistan, including women rights activists, as well as media workers and journalists here.
Now, let me turn to our other guest in Istanbul. Tania, the German president has said that this is the responsibility of the Western powers, as what he called the situation in Afghanistan, which is a human tragedy, in his words. And then on the other hand, we have President Joe Biden yesterday defending U.S.'s policy in Afghanistan. He said there was never a good time for the U.S. force to leave Afghanistan. How do you look at this?
There is no question that President Joe Biden's speech yesterday was morally reprehensible. He placed the blame for events in Afghanistan today squarely on the shoulders of the Afghan forces. Unbelievable. I mean, even those who had supported the U.S. Decision to move troops out of Afghanistan were stunned by the callousness of his his words. All that said, we do need to remember that the Americans didn't go alone into Afghanistan, that they had the support of Western countries. The war had the support of Western countries. So this is a collective failure, a collective international failure of Afghans, of Afghanistan. But to follow on what your correspondent said, the fact is that the Taliban is now in power, and it has an opportunity to either forge relations with the international community or not. They have said all the right things. They have said that they will respect women's rights, that it's going to be an inclusive government. But again, are they going to walk the talk? I mean, it's good to say all these things, but we need to see whether it's going to be how it's going to work out in practice.
Okay. Let me ask our correspondent, Amin Alami. I mean, when you talk to the people in the street, average Afghans, how do they feel about this? Are they optimistic for a brighter future? Do they see a light in the tunnel, any security and peace finally after decades?
Of course, they are not still sure about the fate of their country and the fate of their freedoms, because they have experienced what the Taliban has done during their rule over Afghanistan before 2001. That is why the Taliban are also trying to gain legitimacy among the local people in Afghanistan, and beyond that, thereafter gaining legitimacy among regional countries and in the, among the international community. I personally asked Zabihullah Mujahid, the Taliban spokesman, during his press conference that how the Taliban or the this inclusive government that you're talking about will deal when it comes to relations with its, Afghanistan's neighboring countries, regional countries, and international community. He said that we need to have mutual bilateral ties with our neighbors, and we are also trying to build a good relationship with the regional countries and the rest of countries around the world. This proves that the Taliban will have a very tough job to ensure not only the people of Afghanistan, but also the regional community and the international community, mm-hmm. especially the human rights bodies, international women's rights bodies, to trust in the group and support it inside Afghanistan in order to bring peace and stability to this country.
Okay, now, Tania, what will be the type of relationship between the U.S. and Afghanistan under Taliban, given what all that's happened? Also, regarding the fact that China is also open to closely cooperate with the new government, Russia is also willing.
Well, again, as your correspondent said, the Taliban cannot afford to be isolated. I think they've learned their lesson from the 1990s. They don't want to be isolated. They know that they need international legitimacy so that they can forge relations with neighboring countries. Afghanistan's economy is in tatters. There's a massive humanitarian catastrophe underway. They need international assistance. They need international funds. And they also know that all of these are conditional upon them showing respect for the very basic human rights, civic liberties. So let's see how it goes. They know they can't afford to go it alone, and the international community doesn't really want to turn their backs on Afghanistan either. So, I mean, there is a massive outcry on a popular level in all of these Western countries about the state that the international community has left Afghanistan, Afghans in.
Okay, and let me thank our guest. We had Amin Alami, our correspondent in Kabul, and also Tania Gutsuzian, Afghanistan analyst, who joined us from Istanbul with her comments and contribution. That's it for this news review. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Muharram Special. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. Why did Imam Hussein, peace upon him, stage an uprising against the unjust and corrupt ruler of the Islamic Ummah Yazid? Why did he sacrifice all his dear ones? Yazid, who didn't seek anything except power and wealth, propagated that Hussein too was after seizing kingdom, although he knew well that the only goal of Imam Hussein was to revive Islam. The best way for Yazid to reach his goal was to wage a media war before entering the military encounter with Hussein. This would help him to cover up the Imam's purpose of uprising. Therefore, he tried to convince the people that there would be no difference if Hussein were the caliph, as he also was in pursuit of power. He succeeded to sell the sheer lie that Imam Hussein intended to grab the public property. The Muslims of those days were not insightful and didn't think deeply. Otherwise, they would understand that Islam is basically opposed to any tyranny and immorality. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, was invited to accept the unjust rule that the Prophet of Islam had been given the mission to remove it in the world. Hussein was invited to bury the values for which the best of God's servants, Ali, Fatima, and Hassan, had sacrificed their lives to safeguard. Obviously, the Imam would never capitulate to such an invitation. He would rather call on others to reject such an injustice. When the ruler of Medina called on Imam Hussein to accept Yazid's allegiance, the Imam was so enraged and rejected it. Then he went to the Prophet's tomb at night and said in his supplication to God, "My God, this is the tomb of your messenger Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, and I am the son of his daughter. You are aware of what has happened. My God, I like what is good and hate what is evil." In such circumstances, a big number of letters were sent to the Imam from Muslims in Kufa. They had claimed to reject the allegiance of Yazid and help Imam Hussein in his fight against the tyrant. They wrote to the Imam, "Gardens are full of fruits and the horsemen are ready for combat. Come, as we do not know any leader except you. Make haste, as your lovers are waiting for you." Imam Hussein, peace upon him, wrote a testament before leaving Mecca and gave it to his brother, Muhammad Hanafiye. He stressed in the testament, "I have staged an uprising in pursuit of reform in my grandfather's ummah. I want to bid what is good and forbid what is evil." Imam Hussein, peace upon him, delivered a sermon in Mina before leaving Mecca. He said, "God has set bidding what is good and forbidding what is evil as obligatory, because He knows that if these two obligations are put into effect, all other difficult and easy obligations would be put into effect. And that is why bidding what is good and forbidding what is evil is inviting to Islam and is accompanied by rejection of wrongdoing, opposition of oppressor, distribution of the public property and war booties, getting a zakat and spending it in proper way." Imam Hussein left Mecca for Kufa to revive Islam and maintain mottos of Islam. He told the devoted poet Farazdagh on the way, "O Farazdagh, these are the group who has accepted the obedience of the Satan, left the obedience of God, made corruption explicit on the earth, destroyed the divine limits, drank wine, and usurped the properties of the poor and the destitute. So I am worthier for helping God's religion and dignifying His creed and jihad in His way, so that God's creed is victorious and superior." As Imam Hussein was going closer to Kufa day by day, the people of Kufa were losing their loyalty more and more. The first troop that left Kufa to confront Imam Hussein was the troop of Hur, son of Yazid Riyahi. When the troop reached the Imam, tired and thirsty, Imam Hussein, peace upon him, gave them ample water and spoke to them, saying, "Anyone who sees an unjust ruler considering God's haram as halal, breaking God's covenant, opposing the Prophet's practice, behaving unjustly among the servants of God, yet the former does not struggle against him in the words or deeds, it behooves for God to cause him to enter the place of the unjust ruler in the hereafter." The disloyalty of the people of Kufa led to the martyrdom of Imam Hussein and his companions, and captivity of the women folk of his encampment. But the voice of Hussein keeps reverberating throughout history among generations, teaching the seekers of truth, justice and freedom everywhere to stand steadfastly against oppression and corruption. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, was the greatest student of Imam Hussein's school, as he said, when he said years before the victory of the Islamic Revolution, "If there is a single drop of my forefather Hussein's blood in my vessels, I will not only overthrow this Shah, but will also bring the U.S. to its knees." Imam Khomeini was a man of his words and did what he had promised. Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're discussing Gun Runners, directed by Canadian documentary filmmaker Anjali Nayar. And joining me in the studio, we have Lee Singer, who is a film journalist and video essayist, whose work has appeared in various major newspapers, magazines, and online outlets. And beside him is Tete Coffey, who is a journalist and broadcaster. Now, Gun Runners, which is shot over a 10-year period, follows two Kenyan cattle rustlers, who are also known as warriors, Julius Urile and Robert Mutanda, who put their violent past behind them to become marathon runners as part of a government-sponsored program to disarm the conflict-heavy region. We see Urile enter international marathons, while Mutanda gets involved in the political sphere and dreams of working towards policy change. Though, as we see these once notorious warriors given a chance to pursue their dreams, we realize that the road to glory is full of bumps and detours for these charismatic men. Well, first of all, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, Kenya is known as a destination for world-class marathon runners, but as we see in this documentary, it's not as glamorous as it seems to be a top athlete in that part of the world, particularly because some of them are quite literally running for their lives, running away from crime. And we see that cattle stealing, or cattle wrestling, as it's called, is quite commonplace because that's an important source of income. And this region is also engulfed in the illegal arms trade industry, which is part of a global multi-billion dollar industry. Lee, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, firstly, it's just a fascinating sort of insight into, you know, a situation that I really did not know much about. You know, I know very well that Kenya is a history of producing great runners. I didn't know about this, you know, pretty fantastic government-run program, this sort of amnesty and the disarmament idea, which is a really great one, and obviously gives a great film title then, Gun Runners. The film itself, I mean, I think it was shot over 10 years, so I, you know, you can only imagine how much footage has been accumulated during that time. And I guess, as fascinating as I found the subject and the two principal characters, I felt that in a sort of 90-minute running time, you're kind of skipping big chunks. You know, so much is going on, and I didn't feel that I was getting to know the two men in the way that I would have liked. I mean, basically, I could imagine a longer film that would I would have maybe, you know, it's longer, but you would have felt more in getting into the rhythm of what's going on with these people, because there's so much to say, and they go through so many changes, both of them individually, and I feel 90 minutes doesn't necessarily do justice to everything that's, you know, it's trying to encapsulate.
You're right, it is absolutely jam-packed. It touches on issues of violence, as well as the main themes of sports and running, but then also politics and corruption. There's just so much in this documentary. And Tete, if I could turn to you, what was your take on Gun Runners?
Okay, normally when I'm told about documentaries about Africa, I go, I yawn, roll my eyes and go, oh God, not again. I tend to want to avoid them. I was very pleasantly surprised by this for two reasons. One, it was rich in context, so that whatever was going through the lives of these two, the protagonists, if you like, it was placed within context and it gave you an understanding of the environment from which they came. Secondly, I think it was done with quite a lot of sensitivity. There's little tricks he used in what you call chopping and changing. I mean, cutting from the Rift Valley, training scenes in,
which
in
is absolutely
camps,
breathtaking,
exquisite, in Kenya, over to the skyscrapers of New York. You could see that these are two little people operating in one world, but kind of moving out into a much, much bigger world. And the third thing I really liked about it was that it looks as if these two characters are archetypes. Really is very much the superstar, the very talented runner and so on. And his mate, Matanda, seems to be much more the political type. So how the two characters fare was something I was always watching to see. I was impressed.
I'd like to pick apart their characters a bit later on.
Sure.
Maliv, I'd like to ask you, this documentary kind of describes itself as the American dream, but Kenyan style. It's an interesting analogy. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I'm always a bit puzzled by this American dream. I don't understand why, you know, one country has a monopoly on wanting to change your life for the better and improve your situation. I mean, it's a cute tagline. I think it's kind of irrelevant. The fact is, yes, they do go to New York and, you know, run marathons there. But, you know, marathon running is a world global pursuit. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, to me, it smacks more of marketing than any sort of reality. Why can't it be a Kenyan dream?
Today marks the first annual Tekla Lorupe Peace Race. Tekla Lorupe, the former marathon world record holder from the conflict region, is partnering with the government to invite cattle rustlers to trade in their weapons in exchange for amnesty and a chance to win cows and cash prizes.
As in Lagos, 23, I heard about Tekla.
We learn from this film that this amnesty program is quite inspirational. How does it transform the lives of Arile and Matanda, Lee?
Well, I mean, you know, until this program comes in, they are very aware that they're living a very precarious, you know, highly dangerous existence, and one that they're very clearly both uncomfortable with. You know, it does involve, they don't answer it directly, but you very much get the sense that they've been involved in deaths. And obviously they've had loved ones or friends die as well. So it's just a really unpleasant, you know, precarious existence. So this government program is really trying to give people a kind of a firmer foothold in, I guess, you know, quote unquote, the right direction. So taking them away from sort of illegal activities, illegal guns, and trying to sort of, you know, push their energies and their sort of, their outlook in a more kind of positive and, peaceful direction. So that's a great thing.
And Tete, the film sheds a positive light on this amnesty program. How effective is it really, and can you talk more a bit about this?
Well, there are a couple of things which come out. For a program to work, you've got to be able to transfer skills which are being adversely used or not constructively used into something which is positive. And in the way the story pans out with these two characters, Matanda is very much the organizer. I mean, he had 500... effectively gangsters, hoodlums, they call themselves rustlers, under his charge. So this guy's a people organizer, and of course he's the one whose skills are now deployed in the political arena, actually getting people involved with the program, even campaigning for a parliamentary candidate, and he says he himself has parliamentary aspirations. Then Arile, on the other hand, is the rising star, the hugely talented individual. They said that even as a kid he was winning things at kind of at the local level. So his skills, his competitive drive is now being, you know, applied in an arena which can actually make him money, improve the quality of his personal life, the life of his family, and so on. And it does say that a lot depends on the quality of government, the environment you provide. These talents are available in bad neighborhoods, and they're available in the right postcodes. The difference is that in the right postcode or a stable environment, those talents are able to flourish because they are positively deployed. So in terms of this gun amnesty, Kenya had a problem. I think it was a blindingly inspired idea. It's one of the funniest quotes I actually picked up from this was he said, well, the skills I need to run, I need to be able to run fast to chase cattle, and I need to be run fast to escape the police. And he's doing that in the marathon.
That's exactly the point of this film, is that violence goes hand in hand with their ability to be good athletes.
Yeah.
And Liv, if I could ask you, an issue that is raised in the documentary is that when you have a gun, you have a sense of power. So it seems as if it's an accepted reality or part of life in Kenya.
There's an amazing quote, and to be honest, it's the thing that probably stayed with me most from this film. I think it's Mutanda who's talking. He's like, you know, if you haven't killed someone, if you haven't stolen their property, then what kind of a warrior are you? And to me, this is really then what they're actually really trying to do underline is change the whole paradigm of what makes a warrior or actually a man. And actually, that's something that is a huge, that's not just particular to this country. It's something we probably all need to look at in, you know, different societies, the way we construct masculine identity. And it shouldn't be about trying to dominate and power and, you know, impose yourself. And I think actually, they don't explore that anymore, sadly, I felt in this. Mm. But the fact that he vocalizes it shows that actually it's making him reconsider what, you know, as a warrior he should be doing. And then the fact that he goes into more sort of, you know, political and sort of socially constructive things is obviously helping that situation.
So I know you'd like to jump in, but we're just going to pause just for a second as we take a look at another clip from Gun Runners, which shows Robert Mutanda tell us about the significance of marathon running.
When I was in the bush, I used to run. That's why when I came here, I didn't find it difficult when I started to run. Because I was running even 100 kilometers. You know, when the police is chasing you, also you chase the cattle. So you chase very fast. But if you chase very slowly, the police will capture you. And then you'll be in a hot soup. Look outside, the people are running. Town breathes, eats, sleeps, imagines, fantasizes, athletics.
The odds 1 out of 10 that you can make money out of it. And 1 in 50 to really make money out of it and start really changing your life.
The luck of getting a manager that supports you and brings you to races for around a 15% commission is crucial.
There is a big boulevard of broken dreams here in Ike. A big one, a big, big, big one. But some people walk over the boulevard of broken dreams, still thinking they can make it.
I found both characters to be quite endearing, but I think Mutanda was the more charismatic one out of the two. And we get the sense that he had a much darker past than Relay. There was a moment when he was asked how many people he's killed, and he just looks off camera and remains silent, which is quite chilling to watch. Lee, what did you make of Mutanda's character compared to Relay's?
Yeah, I mean, one of the strengths of the film is that they are very different. So you have that immediate contrast. And Tete's, you know, described it very well. Mutanda's the sort of more social, you know, political animal. He has a natural ability and affinity to kind of, you know, draw people in. Relay is much more kind of, you know, quieter, more sort of focused on his own sort of goals. And so that, I think, is one of the main strengths of the film, because as you follow their paths, you find that actually they diverge more than you might expect, because actually they aren't equally talented runners. So then one storyline really pursues the actual running side of it, and the other goes, I would say, into equally or maybe even more interesting avenues about, well, if you can't do that, it's not just, you know, guns or running. Actually, if the running is not going to be your career, you can use your skills in different ways, and I think that's a very interesting.
And we see Mutanda pursue politics, but then of course we learned that it's seems to be a corrupt world, and it's almost he embraces it and talks about it openly. Tete, is this a reality of life in Kenya?
It's a reality of life in Kenya, and not just Kenya, a lot of African countries. It's also the reality of life over here, but it's because there's a lot more wealth, and because ordinary people's needs are taken care of on a day-to-day basis, you don't see it as starkly. But in Kenya, it's very clear. I mean, he threatens the politician that if you don't make me, you know, minister in charge of security, which he patently won't be able to hold, he wouldn't be able to hold that position. He said he'd mobilize things against him. And but what it says to me is that these individual talents are kind of drawn into this prism of organization, be it the sport, be it politics, be it whatever. And it is the quality of the organization that can absolutely, you know, enable them or absolutely destroy them.
And I want to touch quickly on the point about guns. We find out from in this documentary also that there's 500,000 illegal guns in Kenya. I mean, where are they coming from and why are they there?
Well, I mean, there was the breakup of the Soviet Union, and that led to a huge kind of splurge of small arms all over the world. And, of course, these things are what are required to create kind of little lordships in all of these different countries. And it is one of the saddest statistics of African life that where there are the greatest resources, you have the greatest conflicts. So a country like the Congo, which is incredibly wealthy, has had internecine strife for near on 40 years consecutively. Of course, while that happens, the natives can't benefit from the resources in their land, but other agents do. And unfortunately, it is often foreign agents who enable these weapons to get into the hands of these people. And so that it's almost a system of divide and rule. But of course, you know, if you're a politician in Africa and you're accepting bribes from foreign agents to create conflict and strife in your own country, that's a decision only you can make. Nobody holds a gun to your head to do that. So it comes to issues around personal integrity and so on and so forth.
That's a really interesting point, but I'm afraid we'll have to move on just for the time being.
My name is Julius Arile from Kenya. 6 years ago, being a warrior, fighting with another people from our country. But this time now, I am an athlete, and I can run a marathon.
He really does need to make a breakthrough. And if he doesn't have it, then it's going to be harder to fulfill this kind of dream of being in New York as an elite, top elite athlete that could maybe make it in the top five.
Good morning and welcome to Prague, Czech Republic, for the 19th running of the Volkswagen Prague Marathon.
A great race starting in Prague's old town square in this historic city.
So really is very much the underdog character in this documentary, and you really find yourself rooting for him. He has a lot of pressure on himself to prove himself, and he dreams of being on the wall, as he says, of all the top runners of Kenya. And we see him come seventh place in the first race, but then do really well in the second opportunity he has. What did you make of this sort of triumphant arc he had?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I guess when you're choosing your characters to focus on at the beginning of a journey, you have no idea, actually, are they going to make it? So I think it's less, it sounds a cliche, but it's less about the destination than the journey. It's fascinating to follow this particular man on his sort of athletics career. Now, if he, you know, ends up winning a gold medal at the Olympics, even more extraordinary. But actually, I find it more interesting when you see the real struggles and the person who isn't necessarily going to be the ultimate victor in this. The film really made me think about an American documentary called Hoop Dreams from the 1990s, which followed two young inner-city kids who wanted to be basketball stars. Now, neither of them end up making it, but what you get is a fascinating portrait of their environment and the world that they're in and the politics and the social disadvantages. And actually, that's a more illuminating and, I think, more fascinating storyline than just, you know, the underdog who comes from nowhere to, you know, in the last minute, you know, storms to the front and wins the medal. That's interesting. But I'm more interested in the sort of the world that shapes their, you know.
Of course, he's plagued by poverty and injuries and not the same opportunities. Tete, I see you agreeing with Lee there.
Yeah, but absolutely, the journey's fascinating, and none of these characters are pristine. Arile got somebody pregnant when she was quite young, it led to her suicide and led to him becoming a warrior. But later on, he's now got three wives. And children by all of them. So if he's not able to take that, put each one of his problems in some kind of compartment, he won't be able to pursue his dream. So these dreams are always fraught. And actually the story, as you say very well, is the compromises, you know, the calls that each person has to make to pursue what it is that they're really after. And an illumination of the environment within which all of this is going on. Mm-hmm.
I want to talk now about the parallels we see between Kenya and the US, sort of the Western world. Lee, what did you make of their journey, of Relay's journey to New York, and sort of the observations and comments he was making?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's very much sort of fish out of water stuff, right? So, you know, where they've grown up, where they live, what they're used to is obviously a world away from, you know, the slightly, you know, the more glamorous, the more professional, the more kind of money at stake world that they go into. But I think, again, what's really interesting is in their own world as well, you see the way that they're not quite fitting in and the problems that they have. And to be honest, I would have liked the film to touch more on that. Like Tete says, they have these very checkered family lives. That's not really grappled with in the way that I would have, you know, appreciated a bit more. And I feel that, you know, of course the thread is the running and the marathon and what happens, but actually to get to know them even a bit more as characters and get a sort of a more rounded portrait of them, I would have liked to hear more about those sort of difficulties with the families and the wives and the kids, because it obviously has an impact. He wants to earn money so he can go back and provide for them, but we don't necessarily get, you know, the full story about what that entails.
And Tete, isn't it quite sad, though, that this notion of success, we see Arile move to sort of a shack-like accommodation, and he thinks he's living in a European city. Why is that this connection of success is linked to Europe and the West?
Well, success is always relative to what you've got. I mean, this guy wasn't having three baths a week out in the bush, and he's suddenly in a shack with running water. I mean, that's luxury. He might as well, from his point of view, be at the Ritz Hotel. So it's absolutely relative. But what I think it's important for people to also think about is the fact that this can be quite corrupting. This kind of drive to live in that star-spangled environment can be quite corrupting, because we all know that the industry that he's now becoming a part of, the elite athletics industry, is also incredibly corrupt.
Which is mainly dominated, sort of, as we see, by Western physiotherapists and management types.
So it's incredibly corrupt. So it's really a story about how, you know, man has to try and make it, making moral judgments at every turn of the way in a not-so-easy world.
I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, gentlemen. Thank you very much for joining Doc Review. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambayati.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Heartbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. We'll be right back.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.